uses paints, lengths of stuff, and properties of all kinds which he called his studio. Except for the dust, it looked as though a flood had passed and left the contents of the room in the haphazard relationships and curious angles that only receding water can achieve. After some flinging about of things that might be expected to be concealing something, the artist produced a bottle of Indian ink, and after another search, a fine brush. He made 6 or 7 strokes with the brush on a blank sheet of a sketching block, considered it critically, and having torn it from the block, handed it over to Grant. "It isn't quite correct, but it's good enough for an impression," he said. Grant was astonished at the cleverness of it. The ink was not yet dry on the paper, but the artist had brought the dead man to life. The sketch had that slight exaggeration of characteristics that is halfway to caricature, but it lived as no photographic representation could have done. The artist had even conveyed the look of half-anxious eagerness in the eyes which Sorrells had presumably worn in life. Grant thanked him heartfeltly and gave him his card. "If there is ever anything I can do for you, come and see me," he said, and went away without waiting to see the altering expression in Struwwelpeter's face as he took in the significance of the card. Near Cambridge Circus are the palatial offices of Lawrence Murray. Lucky folk bet with Laurie Murray, one of the biggest bookmakers in London. As Grant was going past on the other side of the street, he saw the genial Murray arrive in his car and enter the offices. He had known Laurie Murray fairly well for some years, and he crossed the street now and followed him into the shining headquarters of his greatness. He sent in his name and was led through a vast wilderness of gleaming wood, brass and glass partitions, and abounding telephones to the sanctum of the great man, hung round with pictures of great thoroughbreds. "Well," said Murray, beaming on him, "something for the National, is it? I hope to goodness it isn't coffee grounds. Half Britain seems to want to back coffee grounds today." But the inspector denied any intention of losing money, even on such an attractive proposition as coffee grounds seemed to be. "Well, I don't suppose you've come to warn me about ready money betting?" The inspector grinned. No, he wanted to know if Murray had ever known a man called Albert Sorrell. "Never heard of him," said Murray. "Who is he?" He was a bookmaker, Grant thought. "Course?" Grant did not know. He had an office in Minley Street. "Silver ring, probably," said Murray. "Tell you what, if I were you, I should go down to Lingfield today, and you can see all the silver ring men in one fell swoop. It'll save you a lot of touting around." Grant considered. It was by far the quickest and most logical method, and it had the additional advantage of offering him a knowledge of Sorrell's business associates, which the mere obtaining of his home address would not have done. "Tell you what," Murray said again as he hesitated, "I'll go down with you. You've missed the last train now. We'll go down in my car. I have a horse running, but I couldn't be bothered to go down alone. I promised my trainer I'd go, but it was such a beast of a morning. Have you had lunch?" Grant had not, and Murray went away to see about a lunch basket, while Grant talked to the yard on his telephone. An hour later, Grant was having lunch in the country, a grey and sodden country truly, but a country smelling of clean, fresh, growing things, and the drizzle that had made town a greasy horror was left behind. Grey, wet-looking, torn clouds showed blue sky in great rifts, and by the time they had reached the paddock, the pale, unhappy pools in the rock garden were smiling uncertainly at an uncertain sun. It was 10 minutes before the first race, and both rings, from Grant's point of view, were impossible. He pushed down his impatience and accompanied Murray to the white rails of the parade ring, where the horses, for the first race, were walking sedately round, the looker-on in him loving their beauty and their fitness. Grant was a fairly competent judge of a horse. While his eyes wandered over the crowd in a business-like commentary, there was Mollenstein, Stone, he called himself now, looking as if he owned the earth. Grant wondered what bogus scheme he was foisting on a public of suckers now. He shouldn't have thought that anything as uncomfortable as a jumping meeting in March would have appealed to him. Perhaps one of his suckers was interested in the game. And Van der Morden, back from her third honeymoon and advertising the fact in a coat of a check so aggressive that it was the most obvious thing in the paddock. Wherever one looked, it seemed, there was Van der Morden's coat, and the polo-playing earl who had been shadowed in the hope that he was the Dago. And many others, both pleasant and unpleasant, all of whom Grant recognized and noted with a little mental remark. When the first race was over, and the little eddy of lucky ones had surrounded the bookmakers and been sent gloating away, Grant began his work. He pursued his inquiries steadily until the ring began to fill again with eager inquirers after odds for the second race, when he returned to the paddock. But no one seemed to have heard of Sorrel, and it was a rather disconsolate Grant who joined Murray in the paddock before the fourth race, a handicap hurdle, in which Murray's horse was running. Murray was sympathetic, and as Grant stood with him in the middle of the parade ring, he mixed adjurations to admire his horse with suggestions for the tracking of Sorrel. Grant wholeheartedly admired the magnificent bay that was Murray's property, and listened with only half an ear to his suggestions. His thoughts were worried. Why did no one in the silver ring know Sorrel? The jockeys began to filter into the ring. The crowd round the rail thinned slightly as people moved away to points of vantage on the stands. Lads kept ducking eager heads under their chargers' necks in anxiety to intercept the summons that would mean mounting time. "Here comes Lacey," said Murray, as a jockey came stepping cat-like over the wet grass to them. "Know him?" "No," said Grant. "Flat race crack, really, but has a go over hurdles occasionally. Crack at that, too." Grant had known that. There is very little between a Scotland Yard inspector and omniscience, but he had never actually met the famous Lacey. The jockey greeted Murray with a tight little smile, and Murray introduced the inspector without explaining him. Lacey shivered slightly in the damp air. "I'm glad it's not fences," he said with mock fervour. "I just hate to be emptied into the water today." "Bit of a change from heated rooms and all the coddling," said Murray. "Been in Switzerland?" asked Grant conversationally, remembering that Switzerland was the winter mecca of flat-race jockeys. "Switzerland?" repeated Lacey in his drawling Irish voice. "Not me. I've had measles. Measles, if you'd believe it. Nothing but milk for 9 days and a whole month in bed." His pleasant cameo-like face twisted into an expression of wry disgust. "And milk is so fattening," laughed Murray. "Talking of fat, did you ever know a man called Sorrel?" The jockey's pale bright eyes trickled over the inspector like twin drops of icy water and came back to Murray. The whip, which had been swinging pendulum-wise from his first finger, swung slowly to a halt.
"I think I can remember a Sorrel," he said after some cogitation. "But he wasn't fat." "Wasn't Charlie Baddeley's clerk called Sorrel?"
But Murray could not recall Charlie Baddeley's clerk. "Would you recognize a sketch?" asked the inspector, and took Struwwelpeter's impressionistic portrait from his pocket-book. Lacey took it and looked at it admiringly.
"It's good, isn't it?" "Yes, that's old Baddeley's clerk, all right."
"And where can I find Baddeley?" asked Grant.
"Well, that's rather a difficult question," said Lacey, the tight smile back at his mouth. "You see, Baddeley died over 2 years ago."
"Oh, and you haven't seen Sorrel since?"
"No, I don't know what became of Sorrel. Probably doing office work somewhere.
The bay was led up to them. Lacey took off his coat, removed a pair of galoshes, which he laid neatly side by side on the grass, and was thrown into the saddle. As he adjusted the levers, he said to Murray,
"Alvinson isn't here today."
Alvinson was Murray's trainer.
"He said you would give me some instructions."
"The instructions are the usual ones," said Murray. "Do as you like on him. He should about win."
"Very good,"
said Lacey, matter-of-factly, and was led away to the gate, horse and man as beautiful a picture as this weary civilization can provide. As Grant and Murray walked to the stands, Murray said,
"Cheer up, Grant. Baddeley may be dead, but I know who knew him. I'll take you down to talk to him as soon as this is over."
So it was with a real enjoyment that Grant watched the race, saw the colour that flickered and streamed against the grey curtain of the woods on the backstretch, while a silence settled eerily on the crowd, a silence so complete that he might have been there alone with the dripping trees and the grey wooded countryside and the wet grass, saw the long struggle in the straight and the fighting finish, with Murray's bay second by a length. When Murray had seen his horse again and congratulated Lacey, he led Grant into Tattersall's and introduced him to an elderly man with the rubicund face of the man who drives mail coaches through the snow on Christmas cards.
"Tracker," he said, "you knew Baddeley. What became of his clerk, do you know?"
"Sorrel," said the Christmas card man. "He's set up for himself as an office in Minley Street."
"Does he come to the course?"
"No, don't think so. Just has an office. Seemed to be doing quite well last time I saw him."
"How long ago was that?"
"Oh, long time."
"Do you know his home address?" asked Grant.
"No. Who wants him? He's a good boy, Sorrel."
The last irrelevant seemed to suggest suspicion, and Grant hastened to assure him that no harm was intended, Sorrel. At that, Thacker put his first and second fingers into either corner of his mouth and emitted a shrill whistle in the direction of the railings at the edge of the course. From the crowd of attentive faces, which this demonstration had turned towards him, he selected the one he wanted.
"Joe," he said in stentorian tones, "let me speak to Jimmy a minute, will you?"
Joe detached his clerk as one detaches a watch and chain, and presently Jimmy appeared, a clean, cherubic youth with an amazing taste in linen.
"You used to be pally with Bert Sorrel, didn't you?" asked Thacker.
"Yes, but I haven't seen him for donkey's years."
"Do you know where he lives?"
"Well, when I knew him he had rooms in Brightling Crescent, off the Fulham Road. I've been there with him. Forget the number, but his landlady's name was Everett. He lived there for years. Orphan he was, Bert."
Grant described the Dago and asked if Sorrel was ever friendly with a man like that. No, Jimmy had never known him in such company, but then, as he pointed out, he hadn't seen him for donkey's years. He had dropped out of the regular crowd when he started on his own, though he sometimes went racing for his own amusement, or perhaps to pick up information. Through Jimmy, Grant interviewed two more people who had known Sorrel, but neither could throw any light on Sorrel's companions. They were self-absorbed people, these bookmakers, looking at him with a vague curiosity and obviously forgetting all about him the minute their next bet was booked. Grant announced to Murray that he had finished, and Murray, whose interest had waned with the finish of the handicap hurdle, elected to go back to town at once. But as the car slid slowly out of the press, Grant turned with a benedictory glance at the friendly little course which had provided him with the information he sought. Pleasant place. He would come back some day when he had no business on his mind to bother him and make an afternoon of it. On the way up to town, Murray talked amiably of the things he was interested in, bookmakers and their clannishness.
"They're like Highlanders," he said.
They may squabble among themselves, but if an outsider butts into the scrap, it's a case of tartan against all. Horses and their foibles, trainers and their morals, Lacey and his wit. Presently, he said, "How's the Kew affair getting along?" "Very well," Grant said. "They would make an arrest in a day or two if things continued to go as well as they were doing." Murray was silent for a little. "I say, you don't want Sorrel in connection with that, do you?" he asked diffidently. Murray had been extraordinarily decent. "No," said Grant. "It was Sorrel who was found dead in the queue."
"Great heavens,"
said Murray, and digested the news in silence for some time. "Well, I'm sorry," he said at last. "I never knew the fellow, but everyone seems to have liked him." And that was what Grant had been thinking, too. Bert Sorrel, it seemed, had been no villain. Grant longed more than ever to meet the Dago. Chapter 8 Mrs. Everett. Brightling Crescent was a terrace of red-brick three-story houses of the Nottingham lace and pot-plant type of decoration. Their stone steps were coaxed into cleanliness and hideousness by liberal applications of coloured pipe-clay. Some blushed at finding themselves so conspicuous, some were evidently jaundiced by the unwelcome attention, and some stared in pallid horror as at an outrage. But all of them wore that nemo me impune lacessit air. You might pull the bright brass bell handles, indeed their high polish winked an urgent invitation to do so, but you passed the threshold only at the cost of a wide-stepping avoidance of these constantly refurbished traps of pipe-clayed step. Grant walked up the street that Sorrel had trodden so often, and wondered if the Dago knew it too. Mrs. Everett, a bony, short-sighted woman of 50 or so, herself opened the door of 98 to him, and Grant inquired for Sorrel. Mr. Sorrel was no longer there, she said. He had left just a week ago to go to America. So that was the tale someone had told. Who said he had gone to America? Mr. Sorrel, of course. Yes, Sorrel might have told the tale to mask his suicide. Had he lived alone there? "Who are you, and what do you want to know for?" she asked, and Grant said that he was a plain-clothes officer and would like to come in and talk to her for a moment. She looked a little staggered, but took the news calmly and ushered him into a ground-floor sitting-room. "This used to be Mr. Sorrel's," she said. "A young lady teacher has it now, but she won't mind us using it for once. Mr. Sorrel hasn't done anything wrong, has he? I wouldn't believe it of him, a quiet young man like him." Grant reassured her, and asked again if Sorrel had lived alone. "No," she said. "He shared his rooms with another gentleman, but when Mr. Sorrel had gone to America, the other gentleman had had to look out for other rooms, because he couldn't afford these alone, and a young lady had wanted to come into them. She was sorry to lose both of them. Nice young men they were, and great friends." "What was his friend's name?" "Gerald Lamont," she said. Mr. Sorrel had been a bookmaker on his own account, and Mr. Lamont was in his office. "Oh, no, not a partner, but they were great friends." "What other friends had Sorrel?" "He had had very few," she said. "He and Jerry Lamont went everywhere together. After some strenuous thinking, she recollected two men who had once come to the house, and described them well enough to make it certain that neither was the Dago." "Have you any photographs of Sorrel or his friend?" She thought she had some snapshot somewhere, if the inspector wouldn't mind waiting while she hunted. Grant had had hardly enough time to examine the room before she came back, with two amateur photographs of postcard size. "These were taken last summer, when they were on the river," she said. The snapshots had been taken, obviously, on the same occasion. They both showed the same willowy background of Thames Bank and the same piece of punt. One was a photograph of Sorrel in flannels, a pipe in one hand and a cushion in the other. The other was also a photograph of a young man in flannels,
and the man was the Dago. Grant sat a long time looking at that dark face. The photograph was a good one. The eyes were not a mere shadow, as in most snapshots. They were eyes, and Grant could see again the sudden horror that had lit them as they lighted on him in the Strand. Even in the pleasant repose of the moment on the river, the eyes had an inimical look. There was no friendliness in the hard-boned face. "Where did you say Lamont had gone?" he asked matter-of-factly. Mrs. Everett did not know. Grant examined her minutely. Was she telling the truth? As if conscious of his suspicion, she supplemented her statement with another. He had got rooms somewhere on the south side of the river. Suspicion filled him. Did she know more than she was telling? Who had sent the money to bury Sorrel? His friend and the Dago were one, and the Dago, who had had £223 from him, had certainly not sent the money. He looked at the woman's hard face. She would probably write like a man. The handwriting experts were not infallible. But then the person who had sent the money had owned the revolver. No, he corrected himself. The person who had posted the money had had the revolver. Had either of the men owned a revolver? He asked. No, she had never seen such a thing with either of them. They weren't that type. There she was again, harping on their quietness. Was it mere partisanship, or was it a feeble attempt to head him off the track? He wanted to ask if Lamont were left-handed, but something held him back. If she were not being straight with him, that question, in relation to Lamont, would alarm her immediately. It would give away the whole extent of his investigations. She would give warning and flush the bird from cover long before they were ready to shoot. And it was not vital at the moment. The man of the photograph was the man who had lived with Sorrel, was the man who had fled at sight of him in the Strand, was the man who had had all Sorrel's money, and was almost certainly the man of the queue. Lagarde could identify him. It was more important at the moment to keep Mrs. Everett in the dark as to how much they knew. "When did Sorrel leave for America?"
"His boat sailed on the 14th," she said, "but he left here on the 13th.
"Unlucky day," said Grant, hoping to bring the conversation to a less formal and less antagonistic level.
"I don't believe in superstition," she said. "One day is very like another."
But Grant was thinking hard. The 13th was the night of the murder.
"Did Lamont leave with him?" he asked.
Yes, they had left together in the morning. Mr. Lamont was going to take his things to his new rooms and then to meet Mr. Sorrel. Mr. Sorrel was going down to Southampton with a boat train at night. She had wanted to go to see him off, but he had been very insistent that she shouldn't.
"Why?" asked Grant. "He said it was too late, and in any case he didn't like being seen off."
"Had he any relations?" "No, none that she had ever heard of." "And Lamont, had he any?" "Yes, he had a father and mother and one brother, but they had emigrated to New Zealand directly after the war, and he had not seen them since." "How long had the two men stayed with her?" Mr. Sorrel had been with her for nearly 8 years, and Mr. Lamont for 4. Who shared the rooms with Sorrel for the 4 years previous to Lamont's arrival? There had been various people, but most of the time it was a nephew of her own who was now in Ireland. Yes, Mr. Sorrel had always been on good terms with all of them.
"Was he always bright and cheerful?" asked Grant.
"Well, no," she said. "Bright and cheery didn't describe Mr. Sorrel at all. That was Mr. Lamont, if he liked." Mr. Lamont was the bright and cheery one. Mr. Sorrel was quiet, but pleasant. Sometimes he'd be a bit mopey, and Mr. Lamont would be extra bright to cheer him up. Grant, remembering how grateful one is when someone deliberately attempts to take the black dog from one's back, wondered why it hadn't been the other way about, and Sorrel had murdered Lamont.
Did they ever quarrel?
No, never that she had known of, and she would have known quick enough.
"Well," said Grant at last,
I suppose you have no objections to lending me these snapshots for a day or two? You'll let me have them back safe, will you? She said. They're the only ones I have, and I was very fond of both of them. Grant promised and put them carefully away in his pocketbook, praying that they were covered with valuable fingerprints. You're not going to get them into trouble, are you? She asked as he was going. They never did a wrong thing in their lives. Well, if that's so, they're quite safe, Grant said. He hurried back to Scotland Yard, and while the fingerprints on the photographs were being recorded, heard William's report of an unproductive day among the bookmaking offices of London. As soon as the snapshots were again in his possession, he repaired to Laurence. It was very late, and the place was deserted. A solitary waiter was absent-mindedly assembling the crumbs from a table, and the air smelt of rich gravy, wine, and cigarette smoke. The distrait minion laid away the crumb scoop and bent to hear his pleasure, with that air of having hoped for nothing, and of having the melancholy pleasure of being right, which a waiter presents to the foolhardy one who attempts to dine when others have finished. As he recognized Grant, he reassembled his features in a new combination, intended to read, "What a pleasure to serve a favorite customer," but which in reality was unfortunately clear as, "Good heavens, that was a bloomer, it's that pet of Marcel's." Grant asked after Marcel and heard that he had that morning departed for France in a hurry. His father had died, and he was an only son, and there was, it was understood, a matter of a good business and a vineyard to be settled. Grant was not particularly desolated at the thought of not seeing Marcel again. The manners on which Marcel had always prided himself had left Grant invariably slightly nauseated. He ordered a dish and asked if Raoul Legarde was on the premises, and if so, would he be allowed to come and speak to him for a moment. Several minutes later, Raoul's tall figure, clad in white linen overall and cap, emerged from the screens by the door and followed the waiter diffidently to Grant's table. He had the air of a shy child going up for a prize which it knows it has earned. "Good evening, Legarde," Grant said amiably. "You've been a great help to me. I want you to look at these and see if you can recognize any of them." He spread 12 photographs, roughly fan-wise, on the table, and left Raoul to examine them. The boy took his time. In fact, the pause was so long that Grant had time to wonder if the boy's statement that he would recognize the man he had seen had been merely a boast. But when Raoul spoke, there was no hesitation about him. "That," he said, laying a slender forefinger on the photograph of Sorrel, "is the man who was beside me in the queue, and that," this time the forefinger descended on Lamont's photograph, "is the man who came to talk to him." "Will you swear to that?" Grant asked. Raoul knew all about swearing to a thing this time. "Oh, yes," he said. "I take my oath any time." That was all Grant wanted. "Thank you, Legarde," he said gratefully. "When you are maître d'hôtel, I'll come and stay and bring half the aristocracy in Britain." Raoul smiled broadly at him. "It may never come," he said, "the maître d'hôtel. They offer very much on the movies, and it is easy just to be photographed, and look." He sought for a word. "You know," he said, and suddenly let his beautiful but intelligent face slip into an expression of idiotic languishing, which was so unexpected that some of Grant's darkened green peas went the wrong way. "I think I tried that first," he said. "And after, when I grow," he moved his hands to indicate a corporation, "I can buy a hotel." Grant smiled benevolently as he watched the graceful figure making its way back to the spoons and the silver cleaning rags. Typically French he was, he thought, in his shrewd recognition of the commercial worth of his beauty, in his humour, in his opportunism. It was sad to think that embonpoint would ever mar his slenderness and good looks.
Grant hoped that in the midst of his adipose tissue he would keep his humour. When he himself got back to the yard, it was to obtain a warrant for the arrest of Gerald Lamont for the murder of Albert Sorrell outside the Woffington Theatre on the evening of the 13th of March. When she closed the door behind the inspector, the woman in Brightling Crescent remained for a long time motionless, her eyes on the brown-patterned linoleum that covered the floor of the lobby. Her tongue came out and ran along her thin lips in a contemplative way. She did not appear agitated, but her whole being seemed concentrated in an effort of thought. She vibrated with thought as a dynamo vibrates. For perhaps 2 minutes she stood there quite motionless, still as a piece of furniture in the clock ticking silence. Then she turned and went back to the sitting room. She plumped up the cushions, which had been depressed by the inspector's weight. She herself had taken the wholly instinctive precaution of seating herself on a hard chair, as if that were the most immediately important thing in her life. She took a white tablecloth from a drawer in the sideboard and began to set a meal, coming and going between the sitting room and the kitchen in an unhurrying deliberation, laying knives and forks exactly parallel in a painstaking fashion that was evidently habit. Before she had finished, a key rattled in the lock, and a drab woman of 28 or so let herself in, her grey drab coat, fawn drab scarf, timidly fashionable green drab hat, and unexpected air proclaiming her profession. She removed her galoshes in the hall and came into the sitting-room with an artificially cheerful remark about the wet day. Mrs. Everett agreed and said, "I was thinking, as it's cold supper, you mightn't mind if I left it set and went out. I'd like to run over and see a friend, if it makes no difference to you." Her boarder assured her that it made no difference whatever, and Mrs. Everett thanked her and retired to the kitchen. There she took from the larder a roast of beef, from which she cut thick slices and proceeded to make sandwiches. She wrapped them neatly in white paper and put them into a basket. Into the basket with them she put some cooked sausage, some meat lozenges, and a packet of chocolate. She stoked the fire, filled the kettle, and set it on the side of the hearth so that it would be hot when she came back, and proceeded upstairs. In her bedroom she made a deliberate toilet for the street, tucking stray strands of hair carefully under her uncompromising hat. She took a key from one drawer and opened another, withdrew a roll of notes and counted them, and put them into her purse. She opened a blotter, worked in canvas and silks, and wrote a short note, which she sealed in an envelope and put into her pocket. She came downstairs again, pulling on her gloves, and taking the small basket from the kitchen table, let herself out at the back door, locking it behind her. She went down the street, looking neither to right nor left, her flat back, lifted chin, and resolute walk, proclaiming the citizen with a good conscience. In the Fulham Road she waited at a bus stop and took such casual interest in her fellow attendants as does a woman who knows what is what and keeps herself to herself. So entirely orthodox was she that when she left the bus, only the bus conductor, whose power of observation was entirely instinctive, could have said that she had been a passenger. And in the bus that took her to Brixton she was equally inconspicuous. Her fellow travellers noticed her no more than if she had been a sparrow or a lamp-post. Sometime before Brixton became Streatham Hill, she got off the bus and disappeared into the foggy evening, and no one remembered that she had been there. No one had been disturbed by the terrific pent urgency that her passive exterior hid. Up a long street where the street lamps hung like misty moons she went, and down another, its exact replica. Flat fronts, foggy lamplight, deserted roadway, along another and yet another. Halfway along this last, she turned abruptly and walked back to the nearest lamppost. A girl hurried past her, late for some appointment, and a small boy came jingling 2 pennies in his joined palms, but no one else. She made a pretense of looking at her watch in the light and went on again in the original direction. To her left was a terrace of the high, imposing-looking houses which the social descent of Brixton has left high and dry, the plaster peeling in large flakes from the walls, and the variegated window curtaining proclaiming the arrival of the flat-dweller. Nothing could be seen at this hour of the detail of the mass, only a chink of light here and there, and the recurrent fanlights of the doors told of human habitation. Into one of these she disappeared, the door closing softly behind her. Up 2 flights of stairs, dimly lighted and shabby, she went, and came to the 3rd flight, where there was no light. She glanced up into the dark above and listened, but only the stealthy creaking of the old wood sounded in all the house. Slowly, feeling her way step by step, she climbed, negotiated the turn without a stumble, and came to rest at the top of the house on an unlighted landing, breathless. With the assurance of one who knows her way, she put out her hand to locate the invisible door, and having found it, knocked gently. There was no answer, and no streak of light below the door betrayed a presence beyond. But she knocked again and said softly with her lips to the crack where the door met the upright,
"Jerry, it's me."
Almost immediately something was kicked away from inside the door, and it opened to show a lamp-lit room with a man's figure silhouetted crucifix-wise against the light.
"Come in,"
said the man, and drew her quickly in and shut the door and locked it. She set her basket on the table by the curtained window and turned to face him as he came from the door.
"You shouldn't have come," he said. "Why did you?"
"I came because there was no time to write to you, and I had to see you. They found out who he was. A man from Scotland Yard came this evening and wanted to know all about you both. I did everything I could for him, told him everything he wanted to know except where you were. I even gave him snaps of you and him, but he knows you are in London, and it's only a matter of time if you stay here. You've got to go."
"What did you give him the photographs for?"
"Well, I thought about it when I went away to pretend to look for them, and I knew I couldn't go back and say I couldn't find them and make him believe me. I mean, I was afraid I wouldn't do it well enough. And then I thought, since they had got so far, finding out all about you two, a photograph wouldn't make much difference one way or another."
"Wouldn't it?" said the man. "Tomorrow every policeman in London will know exactly what I look like. A description's one thing, and that's bad enough, God knows. But a photograph is the very devil. That's torn it."
"Yes, it might have if you were going to stay in London, but if you stayed in London, you'd be caught in any case. It would only be a matter of time. You've got to get out of London tonight."
"There's nothing I'd like better," he said bitterly. "But how and where to? If I leave this house, it's 50 to 1 I walk straight into the police, and with a mug like mine, it wouldn't be very easy to convince them that I wasn't myself. This last week's been 10,000 hells. God, what a fool I was. And for so little reason. To put a rope round my neck for next to nothing."
"Well, you've done it," she said coolly. "Nothing can alter that. What you've got to consider now is how to get away, and as quickly as you can."
"Yes, you said that before. But how and where to? Have some food, and I'll tell you. Have you had a proper meal today?"
"Yes, I had breakfast," he said.
But he did not appear to be hungry, and his angry, feverish eyes watched her unwaveringly.
"What you want," she said, "is to get out of this district where everyone's talking about the thing to a place where no one's ever heard of it. If you mean abroad, it isn't the slightest good trying. I tried to get taken on a boat as a hand 4 days ago, and they asked if I was union or something, and wouldn't look at me. And as for the channel boats, I might as well give myself up.
I'm not talking about abroad at all. You're not as famous as you think. I'm talking about the Highlands. Do you think the people in my home on the West Coast have ever heard of you or what happened last Tuesday night? Take my word for it, they haven't. They never read anything but a local paper, and local papers report London affairs in one line. The place is 36 miles from a railway station, and the policeman lives in the next village, 4 miles away, and has never seen anything more criminal than a salmon poacher. That's where you are going. I have written a letter saying that you are coming because you are in bad health. Your name is George Lowe, and you are a journalist. There is a train for Edinburgh from King's Cross at 10:15, and you are catching that tonight. There isn't much time, so hurry. And what the police are catching is me at the platform barrier.
There isn't a barrier at King's Cross. I haven't gone up and down to Scotland for nearly 30 years without knowing that. The Scotch platform is open to anyone who wants to walk on. And even if there are detectives there, the train is about 1/2 mile long. You've got to risk something if you're going to get away. You can't just stay here and let them get you. I should have thought that a gamble would have been quite in your line.
Think I'm afraid, do you? He said.
Well, I am. Scared stiff. To go out into the street tonight would be like walking into no man's land with Fritz machine-gunning.
You've either got to pull yourself together or go and give yourself up. You can't sit still and let them come and take you.
Bert was right when he christened you Lady Macbeth, he said.
Don't, she said sharply.
All right, he muttered. I'm sort of crazy. There was a thick silence. All right, let's try this as a last stunt.
There's very little time, she reminded him. Put something into a suitcase, quickly. A suitcase that you can carry yourself. You don't want porters.
He moved at her bidding into the bedroom that led off the sitting room and began to fling things into a suitcase while she put neat parcels of food into the pockets of the coat that hung behind the door.
"What's the good?" he said suddenly. "It's no use. How do you think I can take a mainline train out of London without being stopped and questioned?"
"You couldn't if you were alone," she said. "But with me it's a different matter. Look at me. Do I look the sort who would be helping you to get away?"
The man stood in the doorway contemplating her for a moment, and a sardonic smile twisted his mouth as he took her in all her upright orthodoxy.
"I believe you're right," he said.
He gave a short, mirthless laugh and thereafter put no difficulties in the way of her plans. In 10 minutes they were ready for departure.
"Have you any money?" she asked.
"Yes," he said, "plenty." She seemed about to ask a question.
"No, not that," he said.
"My own." She carried a rug and an extra coat.
"You mustn't suggest hurry in any way. You must look as though you were going a long journey and didn't care who knew it."
And he carried the suitcase and a golf bag. There was to be no hole-and-corner business. This was bluff, and the bigger the bluff, the more chance there was of carrying it off. As they stepped into the foggy road, she said,
"We'll go to Brixton High Street and get a bus or a taxi."
As it happened, it was a taxi that offered itself first. It swelled out of the dark before they had reached a main thoroughfare, and as the man heaved what they were carrying aboard, the woman gave the address of their destination.
"Cost you something, lady," said the driver.
"Well, well," she said, "it isn't every day my son has a holiday."
The driver grunted good-naturedly.
"That's the stuff. Feast and famine. Nothing like it."
And she climbed in, and the taxi ceased its agitated throbbing and slid into action. After a silence, the man said,
"Well,
You couldn't do more for me if I were.
I'm glad you're not, she said.
There was another long silence.
What is your name?
She asked suddenly. He thought for a moment. George Lowe, he said.
Yes, she said, but don't think next time. There is a train north to Inverness that leaves Waverley at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. You'll have to spend tomorrow night in Inverness. I have written down on a paper what you do after that. You seem to be perfectly sure that nothing's going to happen at King's Cross.
No, I'm not, she said. The police are not fools. That Scotland Yard man didn't believe half I said, but they're just human. All the same, I'm not going to give you that bit of paper until the train's going.
I wish I had that revolver now, he said.
I'm glad you haven't. You've made a big enough fool of yourself already.
I wouldn't use it. It would just give me courage.
For goodness sake, be sensible, Jerry. Don't do anything silly and spoil things.
They fell to silence again, the woman sitting upright and alert, the man shrunk in the corner, almost invisible. Into the west of London they went like that, through the dark squares north of Oxford Street, out into the Euston Road, and with a sharp left-handed turn into King's Cross. The moment had come.
"You pay the taxi and I'll get the ticket," she said.
As Lamont paid the taxi man, the shadow of his turned-down hat hid his face, so that his retreating back was all that the incurious gaze of the driver noted. A porter came and took his things from him, and he surrendered them willingly. Now that the time had come, his nerves had gone. It was neck or nothing, and he could afford to play the part well. When the woman joined him from the booking office, the change in him was evident in the approbation on her cold face. Together they went on to the platform and followed the porter down it, looking for a corner seat. They made a sufficiently convincing picture, the man with the rug and the golf bag and the wraps, and the woman in attendance with the man's extra coat. The porter dived into a corridor and came out again, saying,
"Got you a corner, sir. Probably have the side to yourself all the way. It's quiet tonight."
Lamont tipped him and inspected his quarters. The occupant of the other side had staked his claims, but was not present other than in spirit. He went back to the doorway with the woman and talked to her. Footsteps came down the corridor at his back, and he said to her, "Have they any fishing, do you think?"
"Only sea fishing in the loch," she said,
and continued the subject until the steps had moved on. But before they faded out of earshot, they stopped. Lamont cast as casual a glance as he could achieve down the corridor, and found that the owner of the steps had halted at the open door of his compartment and was examining the luggage on the rack. And then he remembered, too late, that the porter had put his suitcase up with the initials outside. The GL was plain for all the world to read. He saw the man stir preparatory to coming back.
"Talk," he said quickly to the woman.
"There's a burn, of course," she said, "where you can catch what they call beelands. They are about 3 inches long."
"Well, I'll send you a beelan," he said, and managed a low laugh that earned the woman's admiration just as the man stopped behind him.
"Excuse me, sir, is your name Lorimer?"
"No," said Lamont, turning round and facing the man squarely. "My name is Lowe."
"Oh, sorry," the man said. "Is that your luggage in the compartment, then?"
"Yes."
"Oh, thank you. I'm looking for a man Lorimer, and I was hoping that it might be his. It's a cold night to be hanging round for people who aren't here."
"Yes," said the woman. "My son's grumbling already at the thought of his first night journey. But he'll grumble a lot more before he's in Edinburgh, won't he?"
The man smiled.
"Can't say I've ever travelled all night myself," he said. "Sorry to have bothered you," he added, and moved on.
"You should have let me take that other rug, George,"
she said as he moved out of earshot.
"Oh, Rugby blowed," said George, as to the manner born. "It will probably be like an oven before we've been going an hour."
A long, shrill whistle sounded. The last door was banged.
"This is for expenses," she said, and put a packet into his hand. "And this is what I promised you. The man's on the platform. It's all right."
"We've left out one thing," he said.
He took off his hat and bent and kissed her. The long train pulled slowly out into the darkness. Chapter 9. Grant gets more information than he expected. Grant was studying the morning papers with his habitual half-careless thoroughness. That is not a paradox. Grant apparently skimmed the paper, but if you asked him about any particular happening afterwards, you would find that he had acquired a very efficient working knowledge of it. He was feeling pleased with himself. It was only a matter of hours before he got his man. It was a week today that the murder had been committed, and to locate the murderer from among a mass of conflicting clues in such a short time was good work. He had been favoured by luck, of course. He acknowledged that freely. If it weren't for luck on someone's part, half the criminals in the world would go unpunished. A burglar, for instance, was hardly ever convicted except through an outrageous piece of luck on the part of the police. But the Kew affair had not been a picnic by any means. There had been spade work galore, and Grant felt as nearly complacent, as it was in him to feel, as he thought of the crowd of men working the south of London at this minute, as eager as hounds in cover. He had had his suspicions of Mrs. Everett, but on the whole he had decided that she was telling the truth. The man put on to watch her had reported that no one had come or gone from the house from 8 o'clock last night, when he went on duty, until this morning. Moreover, she had produced photographs of the men when there had been no necessity to, and it was quite possible that she did not know her late boarder's address. Grant knew very well the queer indifference that London breeds in people who have lived long in it. The other side of the river to a Fulham Londoner was as foreign a place as Canada, and Mrs. Everett would probably be no more interested in an address at Richmond than she would have been in a 12345-something avenue somewhere, Ontario. It would convey as little to her. The man Lamont was the one who had been least time with her, and her interest in him was probably less than that which she had for the dead man. He had probably promised in the friendly, if insincere, warmth of parting to write to her, and she had been content with that. On the whole, he thought that Mrs. Everett was genuine. Her fingerprints were not those on the revolver and the envelope. Grant had noticed where her left thumb and forefinger had held the photographs tightly by the corner, and the marks, when developed, proved to be quite new in the case. So Grant was happy this morning. Apart from the kudos arising from the apprehension of a badly wanted man, it would afford Grant immense satisfaction to lay his hands on a man who had stuck another in the back. His gorge rose at the contemplation of a mind capable of conceiving the crime. In the week since the Kew murder, its sensational value to the press had been slightly minimized by other important happenings, and though Grant's chief interest seemed to be devoted to apparently unimportant and irrelevant scraps of information, like the theft of bicycles, he was amusedly and rather thankfully aware that the most important things in Britain today, judging by the size of the heading that announced them and the amount of space allotted them, were the preparations for the boat race, the action of a society beauty doctor against a lady who had been lifted, and the departure of Ray Markable to the United States. As Grant turned over the page of the illustrated paper and came face to face with her, he was conscious again of that queer, uneasy, unpolice-like movement in his chest. His heart did not jump. That would be doing him an injustice. CID hearts are guaranteed not to jump, tremble, or otherwise misbehave, even when the owner is looking down the uncompromising opening of a gun barrel. But it certainly was guilty of unauthorized movement. It may have been resentment at his own weakness in being taken aback by a photograph, but Grant's eyes were very hard as he looked at the smiling face, that famous indeterminate smile, and though his mouth may have curved, he was not smiling as he read the many captions, Miss Ray Markable, a studio photograph, Miss Markable as Dodo in Didn't You Know, Miss Markable in the Row, and lastly, occupying half the center page, Miss Markable departs from Waterloo en route for Southampton, and there was Ray, one dainty foot on the step of the Pullman and her arms full of flowers. Arranged buttress-wise on either side of her were people well enough known to come under the heading left to right. In either bottom corner of the photograph were the eager heads of the few of the countless multitudes seeing her off, who had been lucky enough to get within hailing distance. These last, mostly turned to look into the camera, were out of focus and featureless, like a collection of obscene and half-human growths. At the end of the column, describing the enthusiastic scenes which had attended her departure, was the sentence, "Also sailing by the Queen Guinevere were Lady Fooley Robinson, the Honourable Margaret Bedivere, Mr. Chatters Frank, MP, and Lord Lacing." The inspector's lips curved just a little more. Lacing was evidently going to be managed by that clear, cold will for the rest of his life. Well, he would live and die probably without being aware of it. There was some comfort in that. Nothing but a moment of unnaturally clear sight had presented the knowledge of it to himself, and if he went into any London crowd, Rotherhithe or Mayfair, and announced that Ray Markable, under her charm and her generosity, was hard as flint, he would be likely to be either lynched or excommunicated. He flung the paper away, and was about to take up another when a thought occurred to him, prompted by the announcement of the sailing of the Guinevere. He had decided to accept Mrs. Everett's statement as being correct, but he had not investigated her statement that Sorrel was going to America. He had taken it for granted that the America story had been a blind by Sorrel to mask his intended suicide, and the Dago, Lamont, whether he believed the tale or not, had not sought to alter the supposition of Sorrel's departure. Had he been wise in not investigating it further? It was, at least, unbusinesslike. He sent for a subordinate. "Find out what liners sailed from Southampton last Wednesday," he said, and remained in thought until the man came back with the news that the Canadian Pacific liner Metalinia had sailed for Montreal and the Rotterdam-Manhattan liner Queen of Arabia for New York. It seemed that Sorrel had at least taken the trouble to verify the sailings. Grant thought that he would go down to the Rotterdam-Manhattan offices and have a chat, on the off chance of something useful coming to light. As he stepped from the still drizzling day into the cathedral-like offices of the Rotterdam-Manhattan, a small boy in blue leaped genie-like from the tessellated pavement of the entrance hall and demanded his business. Grant said that he wanted to see someone who could tell him about the sailings for New York last week, and the urchin, with every appearance of making him free of mysteries and of knowing it, led him to an apartment and a clerk, to whom Grant again explained his business and was handed on. At the third handing on, Grant found a clerk who knew all that was to be known of the Queen of Arabia, her internal economy, staff, passengers, capacity, peculiarities, tonnage, timetable, and sailing. "Can you tell me if anyone booked a passage on the Queen of Arabia this trip and did not go?" "Yes," the clerk said. "Two people had failed to occupy their berths. One was a Mr. Sorrel, and the other was a Mrs. James Ratcliffe." Grant was speechless for a moment. Then he asked the date of the bookings. They had been booked on the same day, 7 days before the murder. Mrs. Ratcliffe had cancelled hers at the last minute, but they had had no further word from Mr. Sorrel. Could he see the plan of the cabins? Certainly, the clerk said, and brought them out. Here was Mr. Sorrel's, and here, three along in the same row, was Mrs. Ratcliffe's. Were they booked separately? Yes, because he remembered